In this podcast series, I'm going to give a basic grounding in quantum physics, quantum mechanics, so to speak. I've had experience fiddling around with equations, modelling them on little personal computers, even supercomputers, building some quantum physics experiments, some practical experience, and a lot of the physics is quite complex when you get the full equations, but often you can have, say, a time-independent equation, a spatial equation. Things are actually simplified out, so it's actually quite easy to do some of the basic quantum physics. Now, to make it more difficult is the number of errors that you have in the textbooks, and actual, indeed, errors as fundamental principles that people are taught at school as a fundamental idea. So you've got the physics, which actually is quite simple. You can actually do some things. I think there's the Born-Oppenheimer approximation. There's one simplification. There's another simplification where you can get a time-independent equation and actually make it rather easy to do some basic calculations. So there's that good thing. On the bad point is that often almost every textbook I read, modern textbook, not the old textbooks, but modern textbooks. The modern syllabus has just absolute howlers of mistakes. So that's one bad thing. The other bad thing is the people you encounter who have set themselves up as teachers of this area, and you say, look, well, this is wrong. They say, yes, it's wrong. Oh, yes, it's obviously wrong. Go away, and then they continue teaching the incorrect points. So one of the, I suppose, key incorrect points is the idea that light is quantized. So we'll go into that. The energy of light is quantized. So the light, technically, if you say quantized, it means you have a basic unit, and you can it can be either 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or 7. Or up to an infinite number of basic units or integer numbers. So you can multiply a basic integer number by basic energy and get to any energy you want. That's what light is quantized actually means, and we teach that to our kids. That's a fundamental point, but in fact that fundamentally is wrong. Light can take any energy value it wants. Light is indeed quantized, but its angular momentum is quantized. Now, angular momentum, energy, light, we've got to get really into explaining what's going on here. So this group of podcasts is from the universe of Peter Hill Explains, where I try to do two things. I'm trying to improve my podcast skills, and not by directly learning, but just through practice, being able to speak off the top of my head. And get a few rougher notes, and then speak for an extended period of time. Also delve a bit deeper into it, and just basically let my skill parts of my brain take over. This is where I learn to control my voice, increase the interest, and eventually get there. So if you're listening, you're listening to almost the waste product of my rehabilitation, or my effort to improve in a teaching universe which really hasn't got over the very first hurdle that they're teaching the incorrect stuff. And then secondly, they have this way of, if you're in, you get to go to accredited training, and those trainers will train you up over any problems you have, but you've got to be in the right political slipstream to get any of that. So if you're a persona non grata, you just get left on the side. So you have to think around, scramble around, and try and improve yourself. So you're in the out there in podcast land, you're helping me along, so to speak. So I suppose the most fundamental thing is what produces, we'll get into what is electromagnetic radiation. So fundamentally, space is something which can carry electromagnetic radiation at the speed of light. Indeed, space in our universe is real, but space which I imagine in my book is not real. So in my book, I can imagine space with no properties whatsoever, completely void, and I can actually imagine a true and proper void. It has no resistance to electric field disturbance. It can't carry a wave. So one of the most important things to learn is that space itself, it's the nature of space in this universe, is that it carries light at the speed of light. So there is a disturbance in the electric field, which when that collapses along with the magnetic field, creates a new radiation front a little bit further ahead. That's one way of seeing it. Light itself is one of these things which does not experience time. So once light is generated, it no longer it's traveling at the speed of light, and for it, time has stopped. So that's something to rather think about. So if I look up at the sky at night, that has used to be a brilliant glow, but that glow has gone from blue to reds, deep reds, to infrared, to microwave radiation. So you can still see the glow of the Big Bang, about 43 billion light years away from us, 43 billion light years away, and it's still coming in. And if you tune your radio in, I think they say about 10% of that hiss you hear is due to the light that you can pick up from the Big Bang. And indeed, people can, they have sent out these fantastic spacecraft with stereoscopic, a telescope, which is looking at two directions of the universe at the same time, and it's trying to gather the colour of the Big Bang, the image of the Big Bang. So this is the Planck and the WiMAP space probes, and they have actually... The sexy version of it is they've photographed the face of God, which really, unfortunately, if you actually had to look at it, is basically a hue from red to blue for a Doppler shift. If you take out the Doppler shift, it goes completely white. If someone had to show you a picture of what they're showing, they would show you a completely blank piece of paper. It's completely white. And what they do is they image enhance that by a factor of 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5, 10,000 to 100,000. They turn up the gain, the image contrast, and they get, again, this very slight shift. And so we see the light from the early universe, 40,000 years after the Big Bang. There's a huge cloud layer out there. And again, look, we're up against the know-it-all teachers. Once you say that, they say, look, I don't believe you. This article, it's written by NASA. What would they know? What's the European Space Agency? No, they don't expect you to read deeply in. But if you do, read deeply in, you'll be able to see this. The important thing here is that this light is from the very earliest times in the universe, and the light from that time in the past has reached here, and as far as the light is concerned, no time has elapsed. And in that time, the light is actually inside space, and its space itself is oscillating. And of course, the space has expanded and fallen apart, and so too the light inside it has fallen apart. So that's one way of really understanding that light or photons are actually a vibration or an oscillation inside space. So really they're a note of space. They do have particle properties, but really they're particle properties. When you do enough quantum mechanics, you have a detector with enough wave functions in it, the actual long distance wave will create the phenomena of a particle inside. So one of the things is that this wave is also called a photon. It's a little packet. And this is something that Einstein crafted, summoned out of nowhere. He created the photon, which is a packet of light energy, a distinct packet of light energy. So he invented this in his 1905 papers, and these papers, if you read them, you really have to read all three of them. There's one for Brownian motion, one for the photoelectric effect, which got out photons. Photoelectric effect gave out photons, so the actual photon had turned into a bullet-like particle, which can kick out an electron from metal. This is our second paper. The third paper is special relativity. But he used the same overall thinking technique, which I think people who read the individual papers, or particularly teachers who are teaching in a particular style of AM hypothesis, they read the individual paper. There's things they don't understand, references they don't understand. They skip over it and get the bare minimum out of it. And so rather than Einstein, who's artfully dodging his way through unknowns to pick up a probable answer, people plodding in behind him, not really understanding what's going on, will pick up some things and fall into a series of mistakes. So I just can't describe the number of mistakes that I endure as I hear people explain things, and they say, look, it's based on Einstein. I'm really not going to go into that, because we want to go back to our fundamental mistake that we're coming up against, which is that the energy of light is quantized. I'm saying, in fact, the angular momentum of light is quantized. So angular momentum is energy as a concept. I suppose in a battery, a car, a light bulb, it's energy we might be able to get. Angular momentum is yet another concept. And angular momentum, as we experience it, most commonly is that of a spinning wheel. If I hold a bike wheel and spin it, I can feel angular momentum. And it has this property of having an axis and pointing in a particular direction in space. And it is true. This is something I've got to get my mind around, that angular momentum is a property which is quantized for particles, at least. I suppose a flywheel would actually have, as made out of angular momentum, it will be some integer times h bar Planck's constant. We've got to talk about Planck's constant, so we've got to talk about Planck, another amazing character. So let's talk about Planck's constant. So we've got light is quantized. So light has two quantum numbers, or actually three quantum numbers, but two quantum numbers, plus one, zero, and minus one. Now, zero we don't have in free flowing light. So light, which is light that we experience, which is travelling to us, is either left or right circularly polarised. It's either one or the other. It has its quantum number is associated with that. And a photon of light, a particle of light, carries with it a unit of angular momentum of h bar. A h bar, which is Planck's constant, divided by 2 pi. It's a very small, small number. And this is real units it's a unit of angular momentum, amazingly. It's a unit of angular momentum. H bar is a unit of angular momentum. And indeed, if angular momentum can spin something, is how much spin, surely I can fire a light beam at something with, say, only left circularly polarized light. It will absorb it, and absorbing the light, the energy will go everywhere, but the angular momentum will build up. Conceptually, someone must have done an experiment, and indeed, I think someone in Scotland, in St Andrews, in 2013, did exactly this, reported a small particle being hit by a laser beam with circularly polarized light and spun it up to the fastest rate of any man-made object, spinning it up as fast as any man-made object. I haven't read the actual papers and the reviews of the paper, so intuitively this makes sense. Now, angular momentum in the universe is angular momentum of the universe and spin is all connected together. So after the Big Bang, a whole lot of laws of physics condensed, and we had the ability to move inside space. Newton's first, second, and third law came into existence, that there's no relative preferred frame of reference for linear motion, but there is a preferred frame of reference for rotational motion. So, and this is why angular momentum is so special, and this is why light carrying angular momentum is so special. It means that I can be in a black box with no framework to the outside world, and there is no way that I can tell you how fast I'm moving with respect to another person, another black box. However, there is one thing I can tell absolutely. I can tell you how fast that black box is spinning. So if I was inside that black box and it was spinning, I would be thrown to the outside walls, and I'd be able to tell you exactly how fast it's spinning relative to the universe. So angular momentum is one of the dimensions which has frozen out of the universe, and it is related in a complex way to spin. And look, I suppose the only difference for me is that I've never had friends or a picture in my head that I was going to have to bullshit or to convince someone that I understood something. So I've just been left with I don't understand this. I'll understand it as much as possible. I'll come back and look at something over years and do things. So angular momentum and spin are related. So spin, again, we'll have to go into it. So when our universe froze out, the basic particles, I just wonder whether light has an S2 symmetry. Electrons and basic particles have something called an S2 symmetry. Please look that up in the internet. And so something with a symmetry that you and I understand, you rotate it by 360 degrees, it'll be the same. It'll come back to the same point. So if I put a mark on my coffee mug, I've got the handle of my coffee mug towards me, and I rotate it 360 degrees, that coffee mug will come back to us. But indeed, things have spin, and that's they have spin up or spin down. They have they live inside our universe, but with S2 symmetry. So I suppose at this point, people who are teachers say, that's too complicated, I'll keep it simple. And they, I suppose, avoid you or whatever it is. But look, please look it up on the internet. And look, there's some really fantastic experiments exhibiting S2 symmetry. Now, there is, thank goodness, a physical object in our universe which is shows S2 symmetry, which is a Mobius strip. So you can have a spin-up or spin-down Mobius strip. So to make a Mobius strip, you get a piece of paper, a strip of paper, say 2 centimetres by 20 centimetres long, and you get the strip, and you twist, with a single twist, that strip, and you can twist it clockwise or anti-clockwise, spin up, spin down, and then stick it together and staple it together, and you'll look at it, and this has you have to go around it twice before your finger comes back to the same point, and it's sort of a bundled up dimension. So spin, I've been able to look at it. It's often fascinated me, and we have to discuss this because our atom which produces light is intensely aware of these two universes, the spin up and spin down universe, spin up, spin down universe. These are basically two universes which sit on top of each other, or they sit inside each other. It's something that you will, I suppose, understand, especially if you look at molecular spectra or look at the lifetime of molecules. It'll become very apparent, this spin up, spin down. And over the years, I've looked at how this was derived, and it's I suppose through a beautiful, we've got a beautiful window, a beautiful teaching window, which is unparalleled. This is the way that the original people discovered spin. And some of the best papers, I must admit, are from Linus Pauling. His molecular physics papers are brilliant because there's no computers, there's no maths, it's just brilliant the way he does it. And Dirac, again, is brilliant. So Dirac delta function. It's really interesting because Dirac delta function actually got onto one of these mystery things which you're going to get to. So his Dirac delta function is zero everywhere except infinity at one mathematical point. He actually made, in his mind, a mathematical classical point and used this classical point, which is actually a physical fiction. So it's just so intensely amazing what's going on. So he made Dirac. I've forgotten what his name is. A funny chap when you read about him. All these people are a bit funny when you really read into it. Some of them are quite shocking. I must admit, I've just read about Schrodinger, who had a wife and two mistresses when he moved up to Oxford. Imagine the Oxford dons trying to actually get their mind around this, you know, quantum mechanics and also this sort of strange parallel multidimensional marriage as well. But getting back to Dirac, he began to deal, I suppose, with the relativistic Schrodinger equation. So basically Schrodinger came up with his basic equation. So he came, this is Erwin Schrodinger, this is the stuff of legend, so I've read it many, many times. He was in an Austrian cafe, this is so charged with meaning, and he actually wrote down the first Schrodinger wave equation, which is just incredibly simple. I think he would have written it a bit more complex than this, which is H psi equals E psi. H is a vector, a matrix, or a complex operator, something which really does something, really gets up close and personal, and operates on psi, which is this... psi is an anything. It basically copes with all space and all... It just basically says what's there. So this complex operator on something which is what's there is equal to a number, which is E, times what's there. It's a very interesting thing. Oh, I hope you can keep with me on this. So we're back to saying about light, light being a photon, and for our purposes, through you get a real strong understanding what photon is if you muck around with quantum physics for long enough. But the idea that a photon is actually a particle, a bundle of electromagnetic radiation. So it's not... it is quantized, so the amount of turn or spin inside that photon is fixed. But it can be really any energy you want. But the amount of energy that it... will deposit. So I fire a photon, it can be of a variable energy, a variable length of time, but it's basically its intensity, the intensity of the light times the length of time of that light means that it develops a quanta, not quantize, a quanta of energy. And you have to really go back to Planck's papers and the way that he really understood quanta. So quanta is, as he described, a little box, a little room of probability, a little room between two variables. And so this sort of room of light, if you imagine a little room being shot out, and it can be so high as the intensity or so long as the amount of light. So it can be a very short pulse, but very high in intensity per unit, and that unit will give a certain angular kick to it. And the actual dimensions of that room, the same floor space in terms of the energy versus time is the same, and that's there is a quanta of light, and that guarantees that that light gives the same overall angular kick when it comes out. So to talk about, so light is, let's go through it. Light energy is not quantized. The angular momentum is quantized. The light is developed, is delivered in quanta, which is little rooms of probability, or another way of describing it's rooms or areas in a two-dimensional, say, time or energy graph. So let's get back, I suppose, let's talk a little bit about Planck, and then we'll get back into Bohr and the emission of a photon. So this is a long podcast. I haven't really planned. It's just off the top of my head. So Planck was, I suppose, incredibly, I don't know, he was a real 18th century, or not, sorry, 19th century, careful, decent scientist who just couldn't think at the same level of Einstein. I suppose that's what you would explain. So rather than having faults, he had this amazing ability to stick with a problem over years and years and years. And he was given a problem by the electric light company of saying, now, if I put so much electricity into a light bulb, how can I make this brighter? And he came back to them and said, look, you cannot break the laws of physics. Well, he didn't have this Scottish accent, or that bad Australian version of a Scottish accent. And he said, look, I've been able to work out that light is going as hard, you can hit something as hard as possible, and it's reaches a limit, and this limit is that this light is being put out in these packages. He didn't describe them as packages, he described them as sort of natural limits, boxes in which they came out. So he didn't imagine the light itself was coming out of its packages, which is actually the correct way of doing it. He said, look, you can come up with so much energy with so much time. If you try to get more energy out, the time is shorter, it's just limited. He had built up a picture of oscillators and mixed with Boltzmann in and all got it to work eventually without fully understanding what everything was involved in it. And he had this letter H, and he didn't say, this is my constant, but everyone said, it's your constant that you've used. And so that's been known as Planck's constant. Just to stop on Planck, I don't know the way he thought, the morals of these people. He wound up writing a letter to the French at the start of World War I, saying, you French people, you're intellectually our inferiors, bow to German superiority. The German intellectuals are better than you, so you may as well lose World War II. Lose World War II, he also got on the wrong foot. And, of course, he said, look, I've published this letter, but I didn't know that I was signing it, something like that. And they said, oh, Planck, you can go free. You know, it's hard to believe. Then in World War II, he was friends with Hitler. Hitler said, oh, look, you have to get rid of Einstein, who's already fled. And so he said, oh, look, Einstein, you are now kicked out of the German Academy. And Einstein said, oh, what's going on? I'm already out here in Princeton. I don't quite understand. And he had four sons. I think one of them plotted to kill Hitler, and he lost all four sons in World War II. So he's a bit of a sad chap overall. And inexplicably, this is still unexplained, his house in Berlin got precision bombed by the Americans. So what exactly is going on? It's a bit hard to quite understand. So that's Planck's and Planck's constant. And so Planck's constant is a unit of angular momentum. So the transitions of angular momentum are in Planck's constant. If you multiply Planck's constant by the frequency of light, you get the energy of that light. Again, there's nothing that's going to restrict the frequency into individual steps. So the frequency times Planck's constant is not quantized the energy. So this is a fundamental equation that you tell people that HF is the energy of light. So the number of joules of light, it all comes out, all works out rather neatly. It works out so neatly, this is pretty much the way that Einstein, with a sense of neatness, got a lot of this out. So energy, the energy of light is HF. Now, at this stage, we have to go back into look at how light is generated. So light is generated by, the closest thing we have to it is LEDs, LEDs, or mobile phones. You basically need a charge to move suddenly and move such as each electric field moves and is broken by the creation of the sudden movement of the electric field is damped by the emission of light. Again, this is my experience building antennas and working in signals. You get a real understanding that an atom is a tiny little light transmitter or light absorber. It seems very obvious to think about it, but it's actual electric charge and the positive electric charge, the movement of the positive and electric charge creates a radio wave. In fact, if I was to build a Bohr atom, so a Bohr atom, let's keep on going. This will be a long podcast. I wonder if anyone's ever going to listen to it. So let's build a Bohr atom in your head. So the Bohr atom is, may I say, a complete fiction. I just can't describe how fictional it is. And it was even embellished in 1936. So let's go with a Bohr atom. So in the centre of our cricket pitch is a bag of grapes, blue-coloured grapes and red-coloured grapes for neutrons and protons. But let's start off with a single proton. Now, with that single proton, I have an electron which is attracted to it. Positive charge, negative charge. There's a force attracted to it. Now, if I was to actually build one of these things and actually set it up and I would push the electron around in a circle, that electron would radiate energy. Of course, this doesn't happen. The electron itself is actually perhaps stationary. There you go. It's a standing wave. It's a stationary wave. It's not emitting. But in the atom that I build, I have a little proton. And on a racetrack on the outside, I have this electron spinning around. And so it's got two forces acting on it. Or it's got the coulombic or the charge force, the negative charge and the positive charge of it trying to get together. And it also has the centripetal force. It's just accelerating. So the force is acting at 90 degrees to its velocity, always tipping its velocity over. So the velocity is changing all the time, such that it can never, not changing fast enough for it to ever move closer. It just changes its direction, so it always turns in a circle. There, I've avoided saying there's centripetal acceleration. There is centripetal acceleration. This is not centrifugal force. It's very hard. So people who are into studying science will know that I've avoided saying a dreadfully silly thing. And so Bohr said, look, one of my postulates, I've forgotten his postulates. There's some good postulates, some bad ones. One of the postulates is that all bets are off. My Bohr atom cannot possibly work. So therefore, I decree that the laws of physics are now suspended for my Bohr atom. And people said, all right, continue. This is not going to last very long. But unfortunately, it has lasted way up into the HSC. We're still teaching it today. So this electron, which is spinning around. So you can imagine on your right hand, you're holding your proton, on your left hand you're spinning your electron around. Now he's saying, look, magically it doesn't lose energy. What you're doing here is you can imagine you break that into two points. You've got an electron rather than spinning around, it's moving back and forth through your proton. And there I say, electrons can actually travel through protons. Go figure. It's part of quantum mechanics and part of nuclear physics. Electrons can actually travel straight through neutrons and protons. Well, not that it travel straight through neutrons and protons. You're just going to have to stick with me as I explain this type of stuff. But if I have an electron moving up and down through a chart, through a point, that's the same as an antenna. You know, if I stick up on a radio and send a signal, it's through an antenna. I send electrons up and down through a point. Energy gets radiated. He said, look, I'm Niels Bohr. Niels Bohr I'll have to talk about at some stage. It doesn't happen. And everyone said, all right, for the moment, you can have that. What's happened is that everyone else, now teachers who really don't understand it, say, gee, he was smart. So it keeps on going around, and he said, I can do some great calculations here. It's a ball travelling in a field around the circle. I can use some basic stuff, and I can say which orbital distance. So that's orbits. Okay, so this is a piece of ancient idea of the electron orbits or travels around the electron. Of course, in quantum mechanics, we don't actually have this concept of the electron spinning around. It just doesn't happen. And so this, in homage to this guy, we still use the word orbital, and then we sort of then turn around and complain that people teach it incorrectly because we've pleased Bohr, but we've basically hurt lots and lots of students. So we'll get into it. So this idea, firstly, the electron moving in a circle is equivalent to an electron moving up and down in one direction. So if you have that circle and move it end on, so you hold your electron in your right hand and move the electron in a circle between your nose and away, up, over, down to your belly button, hits your nose again. So that's equivalent to the electron moving up and down in that direction, at least, and it should radiate, but it's not doing it. So Bohr further said, look, I can look at the speed which these things are rotating around and the distance. So if they're further out, they will rotate at a more leisurely speed. It's like the planet Jupiter is further away, it rotates at a more leisurely speed, there's less force. So it's travelling at a slower speed. And he said, these are travelling in circular orbits. And some people I won't go into it. I haven't said, and these orbits are like tracks in space, and I can't tell you why. Of course, we can tell you why in quantum physics. They're on units of angular momentum of h bar, which h on 2 pi, Planck's constants divided by 2 pi, and therefore these are shells, orbits, orbitals. And if you sort of, people say, oh, look, this is hard to believe that they're flat. Atoms are obviously three-dimensional, they're not flat, because I'm standing on a heap of atoms and I'm not standing on a flat Earth. You know, it's got to be three-dimensional. So they allowed that to sort of rotate into the circle, to rotate in three dimensions to become a shell. And he said, oh, these shells have, we'll call the shell one, I'll call it N, after Niels Bohr. I'm sure it's not named after Niels Bohr. N1, N2, N3, and these shells are units of angular momentum apart, going further and further out. And as it happens, this means that the individual shells travel, are reducing distance further and further out as you go out. So the first one, say, is at a Earth radius. The next one will be a little bit less than an Earth radius out, and a little bit less still, less still, less still. And these are your orbitals, N1, N2, N3, N4. And as he miraculously put in the maths, he found that the energy difference between shells, the electrons. Oh, this is other postulates. Electrons in one shell can leave the universe. Say, goodbye, I'm leaving the universe, and miraculously jump through space. These are the classical electrons. Jump through space and reappear at the next orbit. So this is genuine magic. And when it does that, it can either do that by absorbing a photon. And this is quite a reasonable idea, that a photon is an electric field moving up. And you can imagine the electric field getting that electron and moving it up. Or it can jump down, an electric field jumping down, a photon, an electron jumping down will release a photon, a unit of light. This is what we teach our kids. And the difference between energy levels is given by a formula of R, which I think is the Rayleigh number, Rayleigh constant, some constant, times 1 on N initial, N is the Bohr number, minus 1 on N final, which is the, or vice versa for its emission or absorption. This gives you a reciprocal unit, a quarter, a ninth, and so forth. And so what you will do is that you'll have this series, visual series, which is telling you is a reciprocal 1 on N squared series. So you can see that quite simply if you look at the hydrogen spectra. So it was almost like hanging a piece of low fruit, and it was the first person to concoct a series of physical rules and principles to get there, and sort of how much science you can paper over to actually get there. So Bohr was the first person to do this. And so he could explain the light being produced by these electron transitions. Now, it so happens that it's close on, but one of the things that we come from here is that the light emitted, I don't know whether Bohr didn't have the maths to explain how the light was being produced, but when you get into the maths of how it is produced, the light itself, it is true that these orbitals have this is the electron orbitals of N1, N2, N3, and we'll get onto this in a short while, have a change in angular momentum, and the transmission between these orbitals of orbital 1 and 2 or 2 and 3 does carry away light with a change of angular momentum. And so the light itself carries the angular momentum away from the atom. So the atom has a certain angular momentum in it and loses a quanta of angular momentum in a quanta of light. And there's no particular defined energy of it. So at this stage, I'm out here, I'm going for broke, and you may have stopped listening. But I want to get on with the historical baggage. We've got the historical baggage of the word orbital. I want to get into the difference now, or the difference, or how N number goes with the orbital number going through. So what we have to do now is Bohr used the tools of the time, the early belief, pre-quantum mechanics, and genuinely believed that electrons were smaller than protons. And it would make sense if you used your basic logic that if someone comes to, with a kilo of sugar and said, I've got something which weighs a teaspoon of sugar, you're going to say, well, my knowledge and experience is that thing which weighs a teaspoon of sugar is going to be much smaller. But in the real world, the world that we exist in, this electron is actually physically much bigger. So it's got sort of no surfaces. This is one of the things that you have to get used to in quantum mechanics, is that Bohr had these nice objects. I could buy them in a toy shop. I could have it in my pocket. I could display it. You can imagine it. the actual quantum mechanical things of electrons and protons, there is no surfaces. There are nodal lines, which are really important. This is where it doesn't exist, but everywhere else it exists, everywhere else except on its nodal line. So an electron basically fills the entire universe. There's no point where you say you can stop graphing now, and the electron will keep on going forever and ever and ever. And people have, I think, this insane... So Olivia Newton-John, which is a Australian rock star in Greece, had a uncle who used to come out to Melbourne all the time to visit her, which is Bourne. So he had the Bourne approximation, or the Bourne model, which is the Copenhagen school. The idea that... we now know that electrons look and behave like these big clouds. Can we still have our little particle electron? So he said, look, the particle electron comes into existence and disappears. It's sort of like if you photograph it, you can see it every time, and if you overlay all the photographs, it eventually looks like a cloud. We just let's not go there. So let's go to the quantum mechanical view of the electron. So it's an electron, it's an electron cloud. And that cloud, if you can like, can be have nodal lines. So if you imagine a Nerf ball or a piece of cotton wool, which is pretty much a bit more close to it, and you cut that in two, you've basically cut a nodal line into it. Or if you get two cotton wool balls and put them together, there's a plane in there which is a nodal line. So there is this... a homage to Niels Bohr, and it's been sort of bolted together, sort of a Frankenstein theory or nomenclature. And I have to say this because the number of mistakes that I see on the internet, the energy of electron is quantized, that N number is the number of nodal lines and all that type of stuff. I've been swooped by bats at the moment, these large fruit bats. They're sort of rather friendly things around here. They no longer fear me. I'm sitting on this bench for so long and they no longer fear me. And so they're just sitting in the tree opposite. They're just going mad. Okay, quite opposite. So nodal line. So what is a nodal line? A nodal line is where something doesn't exist. Please go on the internet and look at... the dynamic periodic table, you'll see these things with coloured, blue and yellow seems to be the colour of the way they draw these nodal lines. And so a nodal line would be like a guitar string, the point where it doesn't oscillate, is a nodal point. And in multiple dimensions, you get lines. On a two-dimension, you get lines. On a three-dimension, you get a surface, a 2D surface. These are points where things don't go. So let's go and close off before we get nodal lines. So it is true that transitions between a principal quantum number, which is Bohr's number, N, will be equivalent to a change in angular momentum of h-bar on 2, or h-bar. So... So N, historically, N is the number to go to, but N is rather an artificial construct. And again, it's often misinterpreted. So N, let's wait for it, N equals 1. Yeah, N has got 1 in it for free. It's just sitting in there, N's just got a 1. It's got nothing to do with quantum mechanics, it's just historical. So let's shift these ideas together. Plus the number of radial... nodal spheres. It's a three-dimensional shape, and it has these surfaces, a spherical surface. And so this is a point where the electron has no probability of being whatsoever. That's the actual wave function sort of... goes to zero at that point. That's the better way of doing it. I hate the Bourne approximation of an electron having a probability. Yuck. Okay, so you can have the radial quantum number being zero, So that's n equals 1. Or it can be 1, and so there's one sphere of nothingness in an atom. Or it can be 2 or 3 or 4, I think up to 7. You can have n equals 7 or 6 spheres. Let's see, 5. I'll have to work that out in my head at one stage. It's spheres, and these are circular spheres, and if you like it, inside there's the electron builds up in intensity, drops to zero, builds up in intensity again, drops to zero, and as it builds up and drops down and eventually goes into the center. Now, one thing here is that this is quite energetically favorable because you have some electron that you're just going to have to accept it inside the proton. So the electron's bigger than the nucleus, and the electron actually drifts through the nucleus. You'll have to get used to it. I'm just trying to think. This is called the Lamb shift. So it's well understood, well measured. It's a fact. You'll just have to get used to it, and that it's in a different type of space to the quarks, and so they just go through each other in space. And this is why neutrons can actually just float through normal matter. This is another thing which you'll have to get used to. N, a quantum principal quantum number, is 1 plus the number of radial nodal lines, and then plus the number of axial quantum lines. So an axial quantum line is like if I've got an apple and I cut it all the way through, I've created a nodal line. And so, for instance, something which is 1p, it's got 1p orbital in it. So say like carbon, it's got 3 1p orbitals in it, z, x, and y orbitals in it. That is 1p, so that's 1 plus no radial plus 1 plus no radial plus 1 axial, so that's a 2p. So you can't have a 1p, it's always got to be 2p. But it's 2p, it's just saying, even though it's got the number 2, it's only got one nodal, axial nodal line. So if you look at carbon, you'll see it's like your apple, it's been cut in two in various ways. And of course, this is hydrogen. For multi-electron stuff, you can get the electrons interacting, you get a hybridization of these orbitals within the principal quantum number. So it's got the same, the p and the 2s come together, and because of the same quantum principal quantum number, they've got the same energy. So let's go over the various quantum numbers. You've got to have a change in quantum number to produce a change in angular momentum. So 1 to 2, 2 to 3, n has to change by 1. Then you have other selection rules as you go through. So that principal quantum number, n equals 1 plus the number of radial time plus the number of angular quantum numbers. Now, in order to radial angular quantum numbers are pretty easy. There's only one style of it, so you only need one number to describe angular quantum numbers. For radial quantum numbers, you actually need two numbers because you can cut directly through the atom, or you can have a cone of a conical surface. And that conical surface is the magnetic quantum number. So let's go through it. Your quantum number, your principal quantum number, your n, is your radial plus your angular. But you have three quantum numbers, okay? And that really, there should be three quantum numbers. It should be your radial, angular, and magnetic quantum number to tell you, to guide you through which of the, how you're actually cutting the number of radial, the number of angular cuts through the atom. But what we have historically is N plus L, which is your number of radial accretion angular cuts or nodal lines, plus an M, a magnetic quantum number, which actually guides you to which one of these ones are degenerate. So if you actually add a magnetic field for your magnetic quantum number, you can actually select or tease these energy levels out and produce photons of different energy as they transition between the two. So that's my explanation at this point in time. And it's very long, and let's hope it helps. I'll keep on trying to explain this as we get through. I'm up against a lot, quite frankly. I have people who speak to me and they say, "Is that right?" And I say, "No, it's wrong." And then they get in a huff and they say, "Look, I've read it in this book. Is this book wrong?" "Yeah, look, that book's wrong. My lecturer said this." "Your lecturer is wrong." They smile, "Oh, right," and they never speak to you again. So let's see if you can stick with it. My recommendations is to start having a look at these things and sort of really understanding about light. And I suppose the best I can guide you is that, yes, light is quantized. Absolutely, the angular momentum is quantized. The energy is... comes in packets, a quanta, a packet which is a quanta. And a quanta refers to an area of plotted in two dimensions. So I can have an energy range and a time range, and my light can actually squeeze that area. Squeezed is there, and it means that it delivers a unit of energy. So the intensity times the time is... I can choose great intensity, short time, or a long time, very low intensity. But the amount of energy per packet is there, and the actual reason behind that. I'll go through a few quantum paradoxes that people talk about, but I'll do that on another episode. I'm amazed I've talked for this long. So until next time, keep on doing science.